Welcome to Psych Tech, the psychology and technology podcast. My name is Josue Cardona, and with me is Kelly Dunlap, as always. Today, we are going to talk about what I usually describe as a very influential book to me, for me. We're going to talk about Jay McGonigal's Reality is Broken. Is this book at all relevant to your interests or influential to you at all, Kelly?
Well, as you pointed out, this is the first time I was actually early to record the podcast. So yes, yes, I am slightly influenced and excited and have a lot of cognitive and emotional processing around this book.
This is the only book that I own physically, digitally, and an audiobook.
Wow.
The only one. Yeah. Yeah. Because I needed it that way for a number of reasons. So I could not have it full of like tabs and notes and things sticking out of the physical copy. It's a lot easier to do that on a digital copy. It's easy to listen to. And then with Amazon, I can like sync stuff up anyway. And I have read it multiple times. I don't do that with most books, so it hasn't been very influential. And actually, Jane McGonigal herself, I just want to touch on her for a moment. She's a game designer, and the first time I had anything to do with any of her projects was with I Love Bees, the old Halo 2 viral campaign. Mm-hmm. Do you remember this?
Oh, yes. Yes, I do.
Yeah, it was the first... it was the first time that I got so invested into a world, you know, like you specifically make tons of Star Trek references, and Star Trek has movies and novels and comics and all this sort of stuff, but it's mainly like the movies and the TV series, right? And when Halo came out, you know, it was huge. And when Halo 2 was going to come out, there was this huge campaign where there was like something hidden in a presentation on a website, and then you go on this weird website from the link in the commercial, and then it had stuff hidden in it, and actually had this whole audio drama that played out. And it was alternative reality. Like, people had to go to payphones and dial a number and get these codes, and it was so interesting to follow it online and then to actually have this thing come out. And then since then, there have been, you know, live action series and comic books, and the novels are great. Like, I got really invested into that world, and I Love Bees was a part of that. And it was like really influential to me because it showed me that one thing that I like can branch out into many, many different areas. That was huge.
Right. I mean, I Love Bees was epic, and I think you can still go back and I think see the artifacts of it, and the fact that, so your Halo 2, that was 10 years ago, and the fact that it still holds that kind of resonance with you shows just how big of an impact it actually had.
Yeah, and it was really interesting. And, you know, that type of experience, that type of game is something that Jay McGonigal touches on in the book, but that's not the only thing that it's about. What is Reality is Broken about?
Well, I actually have my hardcover copy with me right here in the recording booth, and it is tabbed to hell. So I have no issues with tabbing my stuff. So the idea of Reality is Broken is kind of exactly what the title says. Reality, as we currently know it, is broken, and how we can use games and game design to make a better, more engaging, more satisfying world.
And which
is, I mean, that might not seem as revolutionary as it does, but right now, because there's a lot of stuff coming out about games are for good and the social impact and games for change and things like that. But back in 2010, when this book came out, as far as I know, it was really a pioneer. The Games for Change and movement was still pretty young, and there just wasn't a lot of press around the good things that video games could do.
Yeah, I find myself quoting so many things from the book that I don't remember they're from the book anymore, you know?
They've been assimilated into your being.
Yeah. I think when I reread it, I guess it was last year I reread it, I was like, oh yeah, like all this stuff seems obvious to me now, but when I first read the book, I was like just cheering, you know, what I was reading. I was like, yes, somebody said this, somebody put it in a book, and she's famous for it, and people know about this, and people either agree or disagree, but the conversation's out there. And then, mm-hmm. but now, again, 4 or 5 years later, I find myself completely, like, preaching a lot of the stuff that it says, not so much because I believe it, but because I've seen it, because I know it to be true.
Yeah, I remember having a very similar reaction of the first time. I was trying to remember this morning how I learned about Reality is Broken, but I cannot recall it. But I do remember what it was like when I read it, and it was like, mind absolutely blown. I have a really special relationship with this book because it was the inspiration for my dissertation. And in 2007, I graduated undergrad, and I had done my undergraduate capstone on video games and aggression, and my results found that it wasn't the games that made people aggressive, it was whether or not how comfortable they felt with the control scheme. And I thought that was really odd, and I couldn't find anything else like that at the time. And then I started grad school in 2009, and in basically the same time that we had to introduce our dissertation proposals was when this book came out. And I was going to once again look into video games and aggression, but then I read this book and it really reframed my perspective. Instead of focusing on the potential negatives, which was kind of the standard practice at the time, at least in the field of psychology, focusing on the positive aspects of it. And I'm pretty sure she's got at least a page of references in my dissertation citations. And I know if anybody ever asks, you know, what book should I read? This is, you know, if it's about games and changing the world, this is definitely the number one on my recommendation list.
And the book is not just about video games. It's about games in general, which is something to keep in mind. And I believe she doesn't have a degree in game design. I think it's in performing arts, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Performance art, something. It's a degree she pretty much made herself, and it's a doctorate. So that's also nice to have that little oomph behind it of this is not just, I don't want to say just a gamer, because that's really doing a disservice to people who identify as gamers. But when you feel small, or you feel that your idea is not the main idea or the consistent idea within your field of study, and then somebody comes out who has the credentials to say, hey, this is a thing, and you feel like, okay, there's somebody out there, I'm not crazy, that this is a thing, that this can happen, this is a place for investigation, this is worthy of investigating, it's really powerful.
Yeah. And I like how she, you know, she understands the idea of, you know, an interactive experience, something that, you know, I like how she calls out on Twitter every now and then for, like, she's playing with an idea. She wants people to kind of chime in how she can make it a game. And, you know, she recently did, like, this thumb wrestling thing, you know? Like, it doesn't have to be electronic. But we'll focus on the video game part because we're PsychTech and we do that. So, so where do you want to start on this wonderful, wonderful book?
I think we're going to try and stick to the first part of it, the actual first defined part of the book. And I can't really promise that because, again, like Josue, it's all kind of like been assimilated into my brain, so we might go out of order. Because the idea is to do this podcast on part one, which is why games make us happy, and then have our next podcast be part two and part three, which is reinventing reality and how very big games can change the world. So I know she starts with what exactly is a game. And I think one of the interesting things about this book is that, again, the first time I read through it, this was all shiny and new. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is so amazing. And then I read it again just about not even a month ago after I had completed my first semester of game design. And it was like reading the book brand new all over again with a completely different perspective. So, you know, what is a game? She outlines her conceptualization of what a game is. I think we've talked about it on PsychTech before, that there is no actually agreed upon definition of what is and what is not a game. But that, in the context of this book, it really doesn't matter. It's not an investigation of what is game, what is not game, what is simulation, what is anything like that. But she very clearly lays out what she looks for in a game, whether it's digital or analog, so that you can identify, okay, this is a game within the context she's created.
Which is really important because, you know, she keeps going back to these four things, and it's kind of helpful. I know I kind of look for those things in a game. Again, a game can be many different things, but so she says that a game has to have a goal, has to have rules, a feedback system, and voluntary participation, right? That's kind of the four traits that define a game. That's kind of how she sums it up.
Right, and I think those are generally agreed upon as important things that a game needs to have, especially the voluntary participation, even across the game design literature about what is game, what is not game debate kind of thing. Voluntary participation is a big part of it, because if it's involuntary, it's work. So I feel like that one's really important. And of course, feedback. It's not really a game if it doesn't tell you that you're progressing in some way. So I really appreciated the four definitions of a game. They're clear, they're concise. They are from her perspective, but she's kind of an awesome game designer, so I'm willing to adopt that without much hesitation.
And now that you're designing a game, like, do points like that come up in your classes? Is that something that is there a rubric where it's like, you know, well, does your game have voluntary participation? Does it have, you know, what is the goal? Oh, my game has no goal. Sorry. Then you get an F? Like, is that...
Not so much in class, but because I'm working with the Game Lab at American University as part of my fellowship, you know, we're designing games for companies, for news organizations, for a lot of different people. And I can't actually say what it is, but just the other day, like yesterday, literally, we were talking about a game and I really wasn't feeling it. I was like, this isn't fun. No one's going to want to play this. I don't like it. I'm not feeling this. And we finally got, because it had voluntary participation, because you'd have to walk up to the game to play it. There was a goal, but the goal was for the sponsor of the game, as opposed to the player achieving something. There were rules, just kind of inherent in the game, not that you didn't really need anything laid out. They were very, they were there. And the feedback system was non-existent. And so that's where I really honed in on. It was like, okay, listen, nobody's going to want to play this because they get nothing out of it. And yes, it's really going to help company X, but nobody's going to play it. And if nobody plays it, then it actually doesn't help company X. So I actually introduced a feedback system of just points. We're not even talking some kind of elaborate system, but just like a point system, and also time pressure. So it has kind of a Tetris-y feel to it. And I'm very lucky that I work with some really amazing people, especially my fellows, Joyce and Charisse, and they're like, yeah! And so we really jammed on that and had a lot of fun with it. And we're going to be presenting it to the person in charge of the project. And so yeah, it's great to be able to... I don't think I was thinking, okay, these are the four parts of the game that I need to identify. It just kind of happened, I think, almost as intuitively as a player.
Yeah, yeah.
And then having the support of my fellows and having the freedom to be able to make those kind of changes. But it's always keeping the back of my head that, you know, there's a book I can cite to back up what I'm thinking.
Yeah, yeah. And this book has a lot of research to back it up. And she has a great website where all the research is. Do you know the name of the website? I forgot it right now.
I think it's janemcgonigal.com.
No, she has another one. It's like, show me the research. I think that's what it's called.
Yeah, there's a tab on her site, on her main site, that goes to that place.
Gotcha. Yeah, I thought it was a whole, like, self-contained, like, showmetheresearch.com, something like that. But yeah, it's there. She's not just, these aren't just her necessarily, you know, she's backing up her theories, is what I want to say. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and I think that's why this book has so much resonance, is that you look at the names in the book, and when she cites positive psychologists, you know, as a person in that field, I'm like, okay, those are well-known, respected psychologists. And the second time I read through the book, I started recognizing the game designer names that she cites, because they totally went over my head the first time, because I had no idea who they were. But this time, after, you know, my game dev semester, So she's not finding obscure research. She's finding research from prominent people who are considered the experts in their field. And I think one of the most interesting things is in chapter two, when she talks about happiness engineers and how that's how she talks about game designers, is that they are able to engineer happiness through creating games. That she cites Csikszentmihalyi, who...
You mean she... Csikszentmihalyi?
Csikszentmihalyi. He's got a difficult last name.
Mihai, she sent me high. It's not so hard.
Csikszentmihalyi. Okay.
Yeah.
Csikszentmihalyi. And she points to him as a psychologist in the 1970s who talked about flow, which is another concept that's becoming much and much more popular nowadays. And what blew my mind is that when I went through my undergraduate and my graduate program, I'd never heard of him. Ever. And it just kind of blew my mind that, okay, this is a person that game designers are drawing from who is a psychologist. And so that it does show that this cross-pollination between psychology and game design, but I'd never heard of it from the psychology side. And then you pick up probably the most important book in game design, especially at the time, as far as positive impact goes. And bam, it's right there. So it was like, oh my gosh, I could have known for a longer time that this kind of cross-pollination was a thing.
Yeah, yeah. And that part was super influential to me, the idea of the flow state, because she put a name on something that I had experienced many, 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 many times over. And it was so cool to be able to put a name to it and kind of look it up, you know, and see how to use it in other areas. And the idea is that with games, you can reach that flow state more easily, right? Actually, what is a flow state? Let's define that.
Okay. Well, let's see here. I think the best person to define a flow state would probably be Csikszentmihalyi himself, since he was kind of the dude. And so quoting from her book, from Csikszentmihalyi, it's the satisfying, exhilarating feeling of creative accomplishment and heightened functioning. And the best way to kind of conceptualize it is if you have been engaged in something and the time just disappears and you can't believe it's now 3, 4, 5, 8 hours later. So I feel like gamers can relate to that really well, especially if you play something like Elder Scrolls or really, really immersive environments. But I know for grad school, writing a paper, I can sit down to start writing a paper and 6 hours go by and I don't even realize it. I don't eat. I don't go to the bathroom. I'm just so in the zone. And I mean, that's another way to think about it, is feeling in the zone.
Yeah, that's the best way to describe it. The last time it happened to me in a video game was... it's a game called Resogun on PlayStation, and I was chasing that platinum trophy, which would be the equivalent of you know, getting a 1,000 point gamer score for you Xbox people. And yeah, that's one of those games where the feedback loop is immediate and the action is fast, and it's one of those things where you don't have a lot of time to breathe in between, and I was just completely in the zone, and I did things in that game that I usually couldn't do because it was so hard for me. And right, it's kind of the another description is that you get to that point where the challenge and your ability has grown to a point that is just like the challenge is within reach, and then you get to that point where you are like, that's the sweet spot, right? They can't be too challenging and your skills can't be like too far away. It's like right when you're in that sweet spot where you could just almost attain the goal and then attain it, and then it gets a little bit harder and then you keep going, like that point, if you can hold on to that and keep recreating that point in the middle, that's like the optimum, like that's how you can engineer a flow state for a person. And it's hard. Right. It's really hard.
You're operating on the edge of your ability. And Csikszentmihalyi, I'm gonna keep screwing up his name, he actually has this really cool and very influential chart that shows that if, for example, challenge is too high and ability is too low, then you get frustrated and so you probably don't play. On the other spectrum, if ability is too high and challenge is too low, you're bored. But if you split down the center, that's when you hit that flow space, that sweet spot.
Yeah, and that's why video games and different forms of technology can do that so well, because there is that feedback loop, there is that processing going on where it's measuring you and then making changes to the environment or to the goal or to whatever the situation is to kind of keep you there, you know? And there's lots of different ways to do that in different areas, which is really the most important part of the book, which is not just the game part. It's like she's using games as an example, but she talks a lot about how we can use this in an office setting, for example, and how you can use this in different areas. There's tons of research now into how you use that in schools, you know, to keep students engaged. It's so exciting.
And she talks about that in that same chapter, The Rise of the Happiness Engineers, about people wanting more than what they have. And that's the reason reality is broken, is because we're not getting the stuff that makes us feel whole and accomplished and, you know, happy. And if you think about a lot of people who have worked in, say, a cubicle space, I know I spent about a year working in a cubicle, and it was straight up depressing. I mean, it was X off every day on the calendar depressing, because there was nothing challenging, there was nothing stimulating, there was nothing interesting, there was nothing that made me feel like those 8 hours meant something. And industrial psychology has a lot to say about this as well, that people tend to perform better when they get to see that their work has had an impact, that what they've done, no matter what it is, they've had an impact on the final product. And if they never see the final product, or they don't feel challenged by the work that they have, their productivity falls off, their mental health and happiness falls off, because we're not feeling like we're reaching our potential. And she talks about this as intrinsic rewards. So intrinsic for the psych listeners, you already know what it means. For the not psych listeners, intrinsic, I think we've talked about it before, but it's the internal motivations and desires, that it's the stuff that you do because you like to do it. It's rewarding because it is rewarding to you. So something that could be rewarding to me might not be rewarding to you if it's of intrinsic value, versus, say, extrinsic, which would be money. It's an external source that's trying to reward you, as opposed to something from within yourself.
So like just personal satisfaction, for example, or joy.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Yeah. So, yeah. And she talks about satisfying work. And that's kind of what I just touched on, is the idea that we want to do stuff that matters. I mean, nobody wants... I won't say nobody. Very few people can find satisfaction in rubber stamping something or, you know, tabbing binders for 8 hours a day, 40 hours a week, and having no play whatsoever.
Well, I mean, but it depends too, because like you mentioned just sitting in a cubicle. It depends what you're doing in that cubicle, definitely. It's not just office work in general.
Oh, no. Yeah. I mean, again, I mean, if I was in a cubicle playing Halo, I'd be totally fine. I don't care if it's a cubicle.
Exactly.
Although there is a psychology of cubicles, which is actually pretty fascinating. But the other part of intrinsic reward she talks about is the experience or the hope of being successful. So thinking about what you're doing, you could succeed at what you're doing. And I guess the best way to think about that is if there's no chance of success. So if I said, Josue, you have 30 seconds to write a 300-page novel, there is no chance of success. How do you feel?
Yeah.
It's an extreme example, but there's no motivation, and it's not going to make you happy, because it's like the cards are stacked against you. You're screwed. And that doesn't make people happy to feel screwed.
To the boredom example, there was one of my first jobs was at a medical device manufacturer. It was a factory, and the workers on the line, we were instructed to kind of keep an eye on their productivity, because their productivity would spike, right? I mean, you know, it would peak, and there were like the best performers, after a while, once they peaked, you had to move them out of there and move them to do something else, because then their productivity and their quality was just going to go down and just keep going down, because it's like they mastered it and now they were bored. So you had to constantly switch like your best employees around to kind of maximize their output. And, you know, that's from the employer's perspective, but from the employee's perspective too, it's like, you know, but there's no more challenge. Give me something different to do because I'm bored.
Yep, I'm out of that flow state. I've hit the boredom state. And it's important. Human beings weren't designed, if you want to use that word, to, you know, do most of the work that we do now. Stationary. So that's her third point, is the idea of social connection, that humans are social creatures, and part of us feeling fulfilled and happy is to have those social connections. So it doesn't necessarily have to be, you know, love relationships, but having people to talk to and being able to communicate with others and not be isolated. Isolation is a big happiness drain for a lot of people. There are some people that prefer isolation, but again, there's always going to be exceptions to the rule.
Although, I mean, you know, in terms of productivity and things like that, I'm sure that there's arguments for both. It depends on what type of work you're doing. If you're a writer, you don't want to be surrounded by people all the time while you're actually doing the writing. So,
right, but then they find social connection in other ways.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And afterwards and yeah. Before and after. Yeah, yeah.
I mean, for example, I started doing Couch to 5K, which is a running app that starts you over 8 weeks, gets you from running very, very little to running a 5K, which is about 30 minutes of jogging. And honestly, one of the biggest motivators and one of the things that makes me happy to go out and run, I hate running. I hate it with a passion. But one of the reasons I really enjoy it is because once I'm done running, I hit a button and it sends it to Facebook. And it says where I ran and how much I ran and what my pace was. And I got a lot of good feedback the first time I did it. So like my mom posted, I had a bunch of friends post. I've had other people tell me, oh, good for you, Kelly, cash to 5K. That's wonderful. And so now I have all these warm, fuzzy feelings associated with something that I hate. And so the hate is starting to drop off a little bit. But that idea of social connection and that I'm building an experience. Well, I'm experiencing something, but I'm getting to share it with other people is really, really powerful.
So would you consider that praise, like that's kind of an extrinsic reward? Does that help you? Is that a motivator for you right now more than the intrinsic reward of like the satisfaction of getting to a new milestone?
I would say it is right now, but I'm trying to work it towards intrinsic. You know, because once I can run 5K and I'll feel good about myself because I can do it, it's anytime you change a habit. Sometimes you need a little extra push to do something that's good for you, even if you don't like it.
Yeah.
So there's nothing, at this point, there's nothing intrinsically rewarding about running for me because I hate it with a passion. So, but I know that it's something important to do.
So you're running every day and you're hating it? Like you get to the end and you're like, you're just like spitting on the run because like you hated it so much?
It's three times a week. So it's not every day, which is good. And I have exercise-induced asthma, so running is actually very difficult for me, and the experience of my throat closing up when I run and feeling like I can't breathe is a very real thing that I struggle with. So there's kind of almost, I'm fighting against the, oh my God, you're going to die thoughts when I start running, or my body warning me, now remember, when you run, sometimes you die, you might not want to do that.
Sometimes.
Sometimes, yeah. You know, who needs oxygen?
Yeah.
But so no, I don't hate it. I hate it while I'm running. I hate it while I'm running. But when I stop running, I force myself to grin like an idiot and slowly convince myself that, okay, it's over. It wasn't that bad. I feel really good about myself. And now I get to share it with everybody. I get to share my accomplishment. It was really hard. But that's one nice thing about Couch to 5K is it uses that gradual increase. So, you know, week one is... Oh, go ahead.
No, I was about to go into the point that the application, like, it kind of touches on the different points of a game, right? This is really, you wouldn't consider it a game, but you absolutely have goals. Like, it's in the title, right? Couch to 5K. I did 10K runner a couple years back, right? So I'm guessing that it's very similar. And, you know, every day you have a small goal, and every week you have a goal, and you can kind of go back and see. I don't know, does it give you any badges or anything like that in between?
I mean, it keeps track of everything. I just completed week one and I've done the first week out of week two. So if there are badges, I might not have hit them yet. But the feedback, you know, my pace and how many calories I burned and how far I went. And I also use the Fitbit app. So I actually have a map of every place I ran. And it's really cool seeing the little red line where Kelly was running. And so, yeah, it uses flow state, sort of, like trying to get me there. Because that's what a lot of running is hitting that flow state. Maybe you want to call it a runner's high. I don't neurochemically, I don't know if they're the same thing. I don't think they are. But the idea of, okay, I run for a minute, and then I walk for a minute and a half. And then I run for a minute, and I walk for a minute and a half.
Yeah, you don't have a runner's high yet. Not at 2 minutes
God,
running.
Oh, God, no. No. I don't think I ever have, even when I was running regularly.
Yeah.
But the idea that I'm just at the edge of my ability, or my brain is thinking I'm at the edge of my ability, and then I get to walk. And the start of week two is that you run for a minute and a half instead of a minute, and you walk for 2 minutes instead of a minute and a half. So you're increasing the run distance, but you're also increasing the resting distance. And I was thinking, oh gosh, I don't know. I don't know if my asthma will let me do it, but I did it yesterday and I'm alive. And yeah, so it's speaking to that as well. So
what is your goal with it?
To be healthier.
Okay.
Like I don't
That's
have
a very
any...
vague goal.
Yeah, and I'm okay with that because...
But in the book, doesn't it touch on kind of like you want that goal to be specific? Like, doesn't it help? I mean, I know it does. I'm just wondering how she states it in the book.
Well, like in the fourth part here is meaning. So the work I'm doing, the running I'm doing has meaning to me. In that I used to be very active. I used to play soccer. I played for like 20 years. Used to be very fit and in shape. And then grad school happened and I am not. And so the meaning for me is being healthier, and also because my doctor told me, Kelly, you need to run more otherwise, or you need to cardio more otherwise you're going to die. So there's a little bit of fighting off the Grim Reaper. There's a little bit of just I've tried before, and I think with a lot of people who try to get into exercise routines, it just doesn't work by itself. And so now that I have this, I don't know if I would call it a game-like device that gives me points and it gives me instant feedback and it's like, oh, you just ran a half mile and halfway there, and you know, my little voice trainer is in my head encouraging me. It's helping to take something that I absolutely hate and convert it into something that I know I can do. I can feel accomplished doing.
Yeah. And that's like a perfect example of kind of what she's trying to do in the book, right? It's kind of this idea of how do you apply these concepts from that we know so well from gaming, which aren't exclusive to games, right? But they kind of bring them together so well. How can we apply them to different things? And I think that these type of applications are definitely the like perfect examples of that, because a lot of people hate exercising, especially at the beginning when you're not fit, when it does feel out of reach, right?
When it hurts.
Yeah, and it kind of puts it into those like, hey, first day, we're going to walk 1 minute. We're going to run for 30 seconds. Can you do that? You could do that. We could all do that. Let's do that. You know? And you kind of like, you feel good. And then as that keeps growing, you know, you don't have to think about setting that goal or adjusting those parameters. The technology is doing it for you.
And this also goes back to her talking about the chance of success. Because I can think, if it started me at week 8, run for 30 minutes. No chance of success. That's not happening. But run or jog for a minute. And then walk for a minute and a half. Okay, I can do that. That seems like a goal that I can accomplish. So it's kind of the idea of chunking, too, of taking a really large problem and breaking it down into its smaller, more achievable components.
Yeah, attainable goals are like a key factor in behavioral change.
Yes, absolutely. That's a good way of putting it.
Yeah.
Let's see here. So the next chapter is about satisfying work, which we talked, I think, already about.
Yep.
That you need to feel that stuff has meaning and that it's worth something.
Well, and to a greater extent, like, well, no, I think we covered it, right? It doesn't just have to be, it could be something as simple as in the moment you're entertained and you're not bored. And it can be something as great as, you know, what I'm doing is affecting this over there and it has an impact and it matters.
Yeah, she uses the example of World of Warcraft and phasing. So when you play in World of Warcraft, the decisions you make have very real consequences to the point where it can even change the world around you. And that's really exciting to see, you know, cause and effect, which is something that we don't get very often in the real world. You know, and again, this also goes back to why people, I think she uses the term, or it might be a quote, a mass exodus from reality into like digital spaces is because they're more fulfilling. They challenge us. They can have meaning to them. They are social, especially now more than ever. And that we can get that feedback, get that sense that we made some kind of impact on the world, no matter how small it is. So whether you're contributing to, say, the World of Warcraft Wikipedia, or you go on a certain raid, which ends up changing the storyline, human beings really like feedback. And if you don't believe that, go play with a baby and see what makes them happy. It's going to be reinforcing and giving them consequences for what happens.
Just go into an office and at the end of the day and see how people... Yeah, it's incredible. Have employees, and then you'll see if feedback matters. Be an employee, see if feedback matters.
Yeah, there's nothing worse than submitting something, no matter what it is, whether it's a report or homework or anything, and you don't get any feedback. It's like when you get your hair cut and nobody notices.
Yeah.
At a very superficial level example. And let's see here. So the next chapter is fun and failure and better odds of success. So fun failure is a super important topic. And I think we're going to see that particularly take off pretty soon. I was just listening to the Freakonomics podcast and they re-aired an episode about failure and the importance of failing or being allowed to fail in order to be successful as backwards as that might sound. They talked about the Challenger explosion, the space shuttle that exploded, and they interviewed the guy who was on the safety team who said, don't do it, don't do it, don't do it. But he was overruled because nobody wanted to look bad, nobody wanted to admit that maybe NASA shouldn't do this, and then people lost their lives. So it's an extreme example of failure. But, you know, if they had not been afraid to say, okay, let's push it back, those people could still be alive. And there's a lot of other really good examples in there. But the idea of fail hard and fail fast, so that way you don't waste time on something that's not going to work out.
Yeah, I mean, in the startup world, right, there's a lot of talk about that. And there's also like a backlash to that. It's like, because you can't take that to the extreme either, you know? Because you can't just fail all the time and then not achieve anything. Like, in real world terms, that doesn't look good. You know, there's this, I've heard stories of people who are just like, they're almost waving their they're proud of all their failures and they've had no successes, you know? Like, at that point, you're doing it wrong. The great thing about video games is that, you know, they give you, that goal is supposed to be attainable and it's near and you're kind of making short progress, you know? And you never get to a point, in a game, you would never continue to play and continue to play without ever achieving the goal. At some point you would get tired and you would stop, especially if you're not making any progress.
Yeah, in a game, failure is the opportunity to try again or to try something new.
Yep, and learn something, right? And
learn something new, yeah.
And very few things give us that opportunity where it's okay to do that. Like in real life, you can't just fail a million times and then feel good about it, you know? It's like, well, I moved... Did you move a little bit forward, you know, towards this one thing? No, it's different if you achieved, like, progress in between, you know? But it's a delicate thing that I didn't think about. Like, I used to subscribe to that idea, right? I'm like, yeah, fail fast, fail forward, you know? But, you know, that's something you need to be careful with. But again, it's like games give you this perfect example of how to do it. If there's a super goal, right? Are there mini goals? And did you achieve the mini goals? All right, then you are making progress.
And she also, you know, kind of talks about the culture of failure and how failure is stigmatized. You know, I don't think anybody's going to celebrate being a failure at, you know, over and over and over again. But the idea that if you screw up, it is the worst thing that could happen. You know, if you don't meet this one goal that you set for yourself, that it's the worst thing that could happen. I feel like that's a lot more debilitating than the failure itself. And, you know, obviously, if you're not having any success, that's a different thing. But the idea that, you know, in video games, you can fail spectacularly and awesomely, and it makes you laugh, and you're not afraid to try something new. And that's what I always take away from that, the idea of not fearing failure is... You get to try again, and hopefully you've learned something from the last iteration. And that way there really is no failure, because if you took something away from it and you're not embarrassed or ashamed or scared to try something new, and that's what you got to do to innovate. You just got to keep putting it out there. Who was it? Edison made 1,000 light bulbs before he made one that worked. And it's that tenacity to keep trying, I think, which is why destigmatizing failure would be super important.
I think that the other takeaway is that, you know, we can learn how to design things in the real world so that people don't have to die. You know, there are different ways, there are different checkpoints in between, right? Like, most things aren't as important as people's lives being on the line, right? And that's a fact. But you can still design your process in a way where you have different checkpoints and different things so that a failure isn't that big of a deal, you know?
Yeah, failure should not be the end, and people should not be afraid to try something new because they might fail.
Yeah. Even,
I think it's a good way to
fail. Yeah, most video games don't punish you too severely for failing. Usually there is, I mean, a lot of them do have some sort of punishment, and very rarely is it something like you completely lose your character and all your progress. There are some occasions when there are some games like that, but there aren't many. There aren't too many.
And that goes back to the idea of consequences. You know, I do something and something happens. That's one of the reasons that the backlash from Mass Effect 3 was so huge, was because players didn't feel like all the decisions they'd made, for good or for bad, really had any consequence. And I mean, imagine if, let's go with Grand Theft Auto. What would happen if you drove through the streets and knocked over stuff and, you know, ran over people and, you know, terrorizing the town, and there was no cop chase? That wouldn't be fun at all. That would be really boring.
Although, in the grand scheme of the game, once you get to the end, it doesn't matter.
Right. But to get to that point, to get that overarching goal, there is this tension and this idea of action and consequence. And if gamers in particular don't get a consequence they feel is appropriate to their action, then they can get upset, or they can get bored. I mean, if you accomplish something really heroic and you get only a tin trophy instead of a platinum trophy, there can be that feeling of, oh, well, that's it. I did all of that for that. Or on the other side, you know, it can be too harsh or not harsh enough. But anyway, it's the idea of we like to see consequences. We like seeing what we do and the effect that it has. Let's see here. So chapter 6 is becoming part of something bigger than ourselves. And this is really, really old psych stuff. The idea that human beings want to be a part of something that is beyond them. So she talks a lot about Halo in this particular chapter. So it's one of my favorite chapters ever. But about the massive accomplishments on an epic scale that people playing a video game have achieved, the amount of hours they've put in, the amount of enemies that they've taken down, So working towards an epic goal collaboratively, and how, I mean, I remember when we hit the 10 billion mark, and I was like, "Whoa, we did it! UNSC, baby, woo!" And it was really exciting. And even though it's in a fictitious world, and the idea later in the book is, what if we could take that energy and that excitement and that collaboration and put it towards, instead of fighting aliens, fighting poverty or climate change?
Yeah, and that's the biggest part. Like, people like to take this idea, and she talks about this a lot, right? Like, look at everything. You know, it's not necessarily, she's not touting it necessarily as the proudest achievement, like the best thing that humanity's ever done, which is that we got 10 billion kills in Halo, right? The idea is, why are people spending so much time doing that instead of addressing this other problem? And can you learn anything from that so that then we can all work towards doing that just like we did this? And that, like, that second part of it, a lot of people criticize her for kind of touting those stats. But it's the second part that they don't take into account. And that's, like, the biggest, like, one of the most important parts of the book. And it's that idea that gaming is bigger and bigger and bigger. We've talked about the stats here. We talked about more people gaming. And it's almost like the exodus is growing, right? Like, more people are finding more intrinsic rewards from playing than they get from anything in their life. And And so we're moving, like, sadly, like, in the opposite direction, right? And I love video games, but I also do a lot of other stuff, right? But if everybody's kind of moving over here, imagine if we all work towards this other thing. Do you see it that way too? Because I kind of see us moving, like, everybody's kind of like running away from reality because, like, we're not learning our lessons.
Well, I also, it makes me question, what is reality then? I know my parents used to pick on me and my little sister that we spend all of our time texting. You know, why can't you be social? And so in their reality, looking at your phone is a non-social activity. But for anybody under 30 and maybe even under 40, if you're on your phone, you're probably being social in some capacity, whether you're playing a game with leaderboards or you're talking with friends or you're posting to Facebook. That is our reality. And the next generation of kids that comes up and, you know, are flying around in spaceships, I'll tell them, you know, get off my lawn or whatever. But so their reality is going to be different than our reality, which is different from our parents' reality. And so I don't necessarily see it as trying to escape, but more as trying to find something that makes us, that satisfies those basic human needs. And the idea of guiding that motivation, that power, that huge amount of people, that epic amount of time and enthusiasm towards goals that can impact impact the physical world is kind of the next step for games. And that's what people like Jay McGonigal and the Institute of the Future for the Future, which is like the coolest name of a business ever. You know, that's what they try to do, is to harness this amazing potential of people fulfilling basic human needs to turn it around and reframe it as a way to help humans in the physical world and still get that same kind of, that same feedback, that same feeling or hope of success, that same intrinsic desire to change the world around them.
Ultimately, I get really frustrated when I think about how, like, games are getting better at doing this. And again, okay, so not, maybe not real. I'm gonna use life. Not life. Damn it, I don't know what to use.
The board game.
No. Not real world. I'm gonna use real world. I don't care. Okay, how it affects, how we're not adopting that in other places, like education, for example, right? In education, there's a lot of people doing some really cool stuff, but ultimately, it's still the same boring old shit, and, like, it's so horrible. We talked about this last week, right? There's a lot of stuff there that could really, really improve. When I was teaching last year, I read this book called The Multiplayer Classroom, and it was essentially, like, applying reality is broken to a classroom. And taking all of these different, it essentially made the entire course that this guy was teaching into a multiplayer game where everybody had individual goals and everybody was leveling up to get, like, your grades were levels, right? So you were leveling up throughout the semester. You were gaining experience by doing different things. And there were ultimate goals where everybody was working together. I was like, yes, like, that's exactly what Jay McGonigal is talking about, right? She's talking about learning something from the games and applying it over here. And it's apparently much harder than I thought it would be, because there aren't that many strides. Like, we've fallen into the traps of gamification where, you know, we're giving more external rewards and badges and achievements and trophies and things like that, when, and even something like monetary rewards, like even bonuses, we know that those only work to a certain extent. And if those intrinsic rewards aren't there, and if that sense of community and cooperation isn't there, that sense of meaning, then, you know, we're losing people. And I think games are getting, like, better and better at it. I mean, I've spent hundreds of hours in Destiny now, and it just, like, there's always something there for me to want to do. And then, but then in my work and in my stuff and the opportunities that I've had, lots of things, like, you lose that so quickly that then it becomes really hard. Because I think that the biggest takeaway always from this book is that it's possible to actually achieve a flow state. It's possible to actually have, to actually design things in a way. It doesn't matter what it is. It doesn't even have to be a game. You can design things in a way that are engaging and can keep people motivated and invested. And we choose not to. But it's possible because games show us that every single day.
I mean, it's the idea of trying to get the old guard to move forward. And I feel like that's always a challenge. And games are doing it really well. The game industry is all about out-innovating the other companies. It is innovate or die. That is the mentality of the game industry. And what I've, you know, what I've kind of learned is that used to be the mentality of the news industry, too, is that you have to innovate and constantly find new ways to reach new customers until ads became the sole or one of the proprietary forces behind keeping newspapers alive. And then all risk-taking stopped because now they're answering to the ad people, to the money people, as opposed to innovating to in this arms race kind of thing. And I think that's where people get stuck, is that willingness to take a risk to try something new, because it's going to take a lot more energy to try something new than to just keep doing what we're already doing. And, you know, the idea of making school into a game, I can just see a couple people I know who are older just sneering at the idea of school shouldn't be fun. It's education. You should go to learn. It's not a time for fun. Which to me is just absolutely ridiculous, because when you think about play and the importance of play in human cognitive development and even animal development, and how we learn everything we know about the world first by playing with it. That's why babies put everything in their mouths, because they're and play, because they shake the rattle because they want to know what's going to happen. They're playing to figure out, what does this thing do? Where is it in the world, and how do I relate to this, and is it important? And but yeah, it's easy to get into the rut, and it takes even more effort not just to do the thing, but then to get yourself out of the rut and onto something else. So I feel the frustration, and especially when you see the game industry and especially the Institute for the Future and other places like Quest to Learn, which is a school very similar to what you were talking about, where the entire curriculum is based on a game, and there's some other really great places doing work like this. And it's progress is slow. I think that's the most frustrating part, is that progress is really, really slow, but at least we can see it happening. I guess that's my optimistic hope for success moment.
When I presented the idea of kind of having a leveling system and things like that to my students, I gave them an option. I asked them, you know, would they be willing to do it or not? And it was split about 50-50. And some of the kids were scared. Like, wait a minute, like, what does that mean? Like, I don't know. Like, I don't understand. Like, I think this could negatively affect me or some way. I was like, no, like, it's not really going to negatively affect you. I explained lots of times, and lots of the kids were just scared about what their parents would say.
Exactly.
And I had a lot of parents write in, and they were like, thanks, but no thanks. Absolutely not. I had some parents were like, oh, schools don't do that. Like, colleges don't do that. And I was like, well, actually, I got the idea from a college professor. So you're very wrong. Like many parents are about a lot of things. If you're a teacher, you'll discover that. Definitely has a lot to do with that old garden mentality. I don't know. I'm hopeful in that the more that we play, the more that the demographics are more diverse, the more people that are playing, the more that gamers are growing up and getting into positions of power in different companies, and they or you know, they have decision making powers, there will be some changes. But it's one of those things where once you know that it's possible, I think that's what makes it more difficult. Because if you're in a position where it's almost more, like, you're even more helpless if you're in a position where you can't make decisions and you can't even make recommendations to the place that you're working at, and then you have Halo or Destiny or World of Warcraft to go home to. It's like that contrast is just so, so, so huge that I don't know the answer to this, but I'm wondering how many for how many people that's motivating and for how many people that's defeating, you know, where you're like, oh, like this is even worse, you know. And then not everybody can be like so optimistic that they're like, well, I'm going to get, you know, finish my shitty job and then I'm going to go home and do something cool and kind of fill up those batteries again and then get ready for the grind tomorrow. Not everybody can do that. And even people who can, like, you got to be really, really resilient, right, to be able to have that long term.
And even if you have something really fun to go home to, that doesn't mean that you want the other part of your life to suck. And like my best example, my internship year was awful. I mean, there's just no other way to say it. It was absolutely awful. And I felt like the scum on the bottom of somebody's shoe. And I would go home and suddenly I'm not, you know, Kelly the student, but I'm Kelly, you know, the owner of Griffball Hub. And I'm organizing leagues and I'm settling disputes. And on the weekends, I'm going to conferences to talk about mental health and video games. And I'm seen as an authority and I get to, you know, share my ideas with people. And then it's back to the grind, which is miserable. So, yeah, I would much rather, you know, have the video games there as almost as a hobby, as opposed to, I don't want to say a crutch because that has a negative connotation to it, but it's something I need to recharge my batteries, I guess, is the best way to say it.
Yeah, positive psychology is all about that recharging part, right? Even if you have nothing negative, right, in your life, even at that point, there's still stuff that you can do that can make everything better, right? You can increase happiness. You can increase all these different positive qualities. And life is a balance. You're constantly balancing those out. And unfortunately, 9 to 5... 5 days a week is exhausting, and it is sometimes there isn't enough time actually. There actually isn't enough time outside of those 40 hours a week to replenish those batteries, right? You don't have another extra 40 really to refill and then go back to that.
And then imagine if you have children and they've got to go to soccer practice and they've got to do this and they've got to do that and you've got to take care of them, which is important. But then the time for you gets even smaller. And you know, that's assuming you only have one job and you have the luxury of coming home after your shift. You know, there's people who work 2 or 3 jobs and there is no downtime. And again, it's so upsetting to me that the idea of play has such a stigma attached to it. I was at one of my meetings for my fellowship and I suggested like a topic or calling something play. And there were a couple people who looked at me like I was crazy, that, well, that means that's not serious. That's not, you know, play. That's what children do. And I'm like, no, play is super important. And it makes life better. And it's not just for children. It's so critical for adults to play too. And, you know, I'm, thankfully they're very receptive and they're very kind and they want to learn. So we were able to talk it out. But there's a lot of other professions and professionals who the idea of play not being serious or what's the word I'm looking for? Constructive or producing anything. And it's trying to get that idea. If nothing else, that might be the first step, is to get people to accept that play is not something that just children do and play is not something with no value. There's actually a quote in McGonagall's book about the importance there. Sure, there are several quotes in McGonagall's book about the importance of play for the human psyche. Just for humans to exist, we have to play. And I guess that's where my optimistic hope is that people will slowly but surely, as gamers take over the world, accept that play is important.
Well, Schaefer, the grandfather of play therapy, he talks about how play is the language of children, right? I use that quote all the time. But we have to get to the point, kind of like, I think we need to be better at convincing people, right? We don't have to just call it play. If somebody's resistant to it, we can go around that and use all of the pieces to it, right? Especially if people are resistant to that word. I think, you know, there's ways to do it. And there's the psychology of motivation and of intrinsic reward, that it's so important. And I know the video game companies are hiring professionals to do that, and they're studying and they fine-tune the experience for that, right? And And if other companies saw it the same way, like, yeah, it will, you'll have happier employees, you'll have a more productive workforce, you will make more money. It's like, it's a good investment. Just like video games will make more money if people are more invested in their products, companies can do the same thing. And, you know, I've been out of the, I haven't had like a corporate or office job in a while. So I'm hopeful that, you know, whenever speakers come in and they do activities and stuff like that, these are kind of some of the activities or some of the concepts that they're touching upon, you know? Although I don't know how many companies are willing to have somebody come in and show them how depressed they really are at work. They probably don't realize it.
That's where the Fitbit will come in. Or the student life app for the workplace.
Yes.
But I think the last thing I want to observe before we wrap up is game companies and game designers hire psychologists. They hire sociologists. They hire graphics designers. They hire musicians. They hire artists. They hire architecture people. They hire architects. They hire everybody, and they create this amazing product that just is so interdisciplinary. But then you look at, say, psychology. Psychologists don't hire game designers. I mean, that would be absurd. You know, as far as I know, sociologists don't hire game designers. Research labs don't hire game designers. I don't know if architects do or not, and I don't know if musicians do or not, but the idea that the gaming community is so open and they realize, let's not be siloed. Let's get our hands into every pot to make our experiences better. It's such an opposite facing perspective on the world than more established, quote unquote, traditional mediums such as, say, psychology.
Yeah. And this is a good place to stop, because I think then next week we'll talk about how, like, we'll give specific examples of people who are actually kind of applying certain things or real life examples of the games that she's created or examples that she brings up in the book. They're really good. And
yeah, that's a really good place to leave off, because yeah, the natural segue would be to Super Better.
Yeah.
So
yeah. Yep. Absolutely. All right. So that was our part one discussion of Reality is Broken, a book that is somewhat influential to us.
Just a tiny bit.
Just a tiny bit. And so for more Psych Tech, visit us at psychtechpodcast.com or follow us on Twitter at psychtechcast. And for Josue and Kelly, thank you, and we'll see you next week.
See ya.